move into some of the stages along the spectrum of diet and kind of relate that to, you know, how a person operates within society. I think that that's, that's important as well.
Yes. So one of the things that we have benefited from in the West, from being able to look at anthropology and sociology and study psychology and look at multiple cultures worldwide, is we can see various kinds of developmental schemes playing out. True development that's playing out. One line of development is worldview. And I've matched up worldview with the way that we eat. And when, as we go through this, this will start to make a lot of sense for many of us who are in a plant-based approach and why we see the types of qualities or the types of talking that we do in the plant-based community. So there was a psychologist named Gene Gebser who came up with a worldview developmental model. And that worldview developmental model has also been adapted into something called, and I know I'm giving some words you guys have never heard before. So like Kevin said, you can go back and listen to this or Google it. Google spiral dynamics. Spiral dynamics, what the heck is that? It's a worldview developmental model. Okay, what is a worldview? It's the way, it's the lenses through which you look out onto the world and how you interpret what it is that's going on out there and how you decide to behave out there in the world. So your worldview will impact the kinds of relationships that you're in, the car that you drive or don't drive, types of food that you eat, the books that you read, the types of political discourse that you do or don't enter into, etc. It's they're big, thick glasses that we put on. And there's definitely very discernible levels of worldview that we go through. And what I'm suggesting with the spectrum of diet, because I'm going to go through these worldview developmental levels to make a whole lot of sense of this, is that those worldview levels that we're all going through play out very well along the spectrum of diet. And you can see that, quote unquote, lower. And when I say lower, I don't mean to demean them. I'm just saying earlier levels of worldview development match up very well with earlier levels of the spectrum of diet. And more developed worldviews tend to work better with higher levels of the spectrum of diet and actually encourage one to eat higher up on the spectrum. Okay. So I'm going to take you through those now, but you can Google spectrum of diet, or not spectrum of diet, I apologize, spiral dynamics, and you can find this. Now, spiral dynamics was developed by a guy named Don Beck. Don Beck used this worldview developmental model to help heal apartheid in South Africa. You had so many different groups speaking about their opinions about things, and it was chaotic. And so you've got this cultural group and that cultural group and this skin color and that skin color, and it's very confusing and hard to deal with. And so Don Beck came in with spiral dynamics, and he said, look, we're going to get rid of the cultural distinctions for a little while and the differences in skin color, et cetera, and we're going to start to talk about perspectives from different levels of worldview. Now, a high level of worldview development would incorporate the most perspectives possible. And a lower level of worldview development wouldn't incorporate very many perspectives or take on the care and concern of very many people. So as we're going through this, you'll see the move from egocentric into more sociocentric into more world-centric or cosmocentric. Okay. So what are the worldview developmental stages that an individual goes through? But you'll also see as we stretch back into time throughout human history, this is where we get into the anthropological record, this is the story of humanity itself. What's the story? What's this developmental model? What does it look like? The move is this, from archaic into more magic thinking. Magic gives rise into more mythic thinking. I'll qualify all these in just a moment. Archaic into magic, into more mythic, into a more rational type of thinking, into more pluralistic thinking, meaning taking on multiple perspectives, and finally into more integral thinking. Okay, so let's go back and let's just look at some of the qualities of some of these different levels of being. Now, if you find all this interesting, you can find this in A Theory of Everything by Ken Wilber. He talks about spiral dynamics, this worldview developmental scheme. But I'm just going to give you some examples of these different levels of worldview, and then we're going to directly apply it to the spectrum of diet. So archaic would be the first one. What are we looking at with archaic? Who would be kind of in an archaic level of existence? This would be the first human societies, or a newborn infant, or the senile elderly, a late-stage Alzheimer's victim, somebody who's mentally ill and who lives on the street. These folks are not really able to take on the care and concern of even themselves oftentimes. Okay? It's really just living like for the moment. And when we mean for the moment, not like in the expansive present, but like there just isn't anything else I could even think of or consider. Okay? Now, where along the spectrum of diet would an archaic level of existence fit? Junk food and fast food, for sure. It's just whatever tastes good to me and is immediately available to me right now, whatever it is that I can eat, kind of thing. Okay. Not much depth there. As we move out of archaic into more magic, you start to see rituals, ethnic beliefs, being on athletic teams or being in a gang, James Bond villains, gang leaders, soldiers of fortune, wild rock stars, Lord of the Flies, being in a survival band, so to speak. Now, a lot of us who move into elementary school and junior high can really recognize this stage, okay, for moving into archaic, into more magic thinking. We believe that if we stick a pin into a doll or if we wish that it would rain or that we had superhero powers, that we actually do. And we create groups around ourselves who play in this domain. We read comics. We play with characters or we play with dolls, that kind of thing. We like magic. We believe in magic. It, at that level, it's the truth for us. Well, who that thinks magically or what would magic thinking incline us to eat? Lucky Charms. Go to McDonald's and get the latest Happy Meal with whatever the Happy Meal toy is. Or, you know, Buzz Lightning is advertising something at McDonald's. You know, cartoon characters. The foods that are advertised by cartoon characters are what somebody's going to eat at a magical level of thinking. Okay? It's very colorful. It's still, it's just early ethnocentric way of eating. So archaic gives rise into magic. And the diet that goes along with that, magic gives rise into mythic. Now, with magic, as you get older, you realize, well, you know, I stuck a pin into a doll or I drew a picture of somebody and crossed it out or I burned it up or I wished that it would rain. And all these things didn't actually happen. And so we give over the power to control the world to a higher power. And so this is the rise of ancient nation states and oftentimes monotheism, okay, belief in one God. So this would be Judaism or Christianity or Islam, for example. Okay? And the nation states that were created around this particular level of worldview development, which is quite far beyond just tribes or survival bands. There's a lot more organization here. It's a lot more development when you get into mythic thinking or what we also call conventional. Okay? Think Boy Scouts of America. Think My Country, Right or Wrong. Think good deeds or religious fundamentalism. The moral majority, being patriotic, codes of chivalry and honor. Now, we take these on. These are parts of ourselves. I mean, when I got to that age, I went into the Boy Scouts. I was going to church. I was taking on a code of morals that I held dear. I said, I care about taking care of myself and my family and my nation, and so I'm going to live by all these things that we talked about in Boy Scouts, you know, or that you talk about at church, the Ten Commandments, that kind of thing. And so there's a level of morality that's at play there. Now, if you're at that conventional level, what kind of food do you eat? Well, who do you associate with? Well, you associate most of the people who are around you, and you pretty much eat what they eat, which in Western society is a standard American or standard Western diet. Okay. So a person at conventional or mythic thinking believes in the myths. Now, I don't mean to be putting these down because as a mystic, I believe that all of these stages are extremely important and I would never do away with any of them. They're very important. But if you're at mythic, you believe that Moses really parted the Red Sea or that when the Buddha was born and he took his first steps, that flowers actually sprouted up out of the ground or that Jesus really was born of a virgin and that's very important to you. You believe it as literally true. It's called mythic literal thinking. Every word in the Bible or the Quran or the Torah is literally true all the way through. Okay? That's mythic literal thinking. It's very important for establishing a strong family, a strong work ethic, a strong nation. And that is the worldview that we use this and the next one to develop industrialized agriculture and eat the way that we've eaten for the last 100 or so years. Okay? Now, eventually, you get into college, a lot of us get into college, and we say, you know, I don't really believe in all those myths anymore. I mean, whether or not Jesus was born of a virgin or Moses parted the Red Sea or some of the other like miracles that I read about in the Bible or the Torah or in the Quran, those things don't really matter to me so much anymore. I don't think so mythically anymore. And in fact, I'm in college with people from all over the world. And I really like the way this person from India thinks or this Japanese Buddhist thinks or that they eat or whatever. And so you're also getting into more scientific thinking, and this is the next level. Now, let me just recap here, because I know we don't have this all, like, if we were doing this by video, we would just have this up on the screen. You've moved from archaic into more magic thinking, and magic has given way into mythic, conventional, or literal thinking, which is very important for the strength of family and society. And eventually you let go of some of those myths, and you've started to take on more of a scientific way of thinking about things. I don't think there really was a great flood, maybe. No, I don't know if it's even important to me, but you know what is important to me is science and rationality. And I can be rational and still be really kind to people. And that rational mind applied to nutrition says, processed food actually doesn't have all that much for me. I can't believe we ate donuts when we went to youth group at church, you know, or all the crap that we ate, you know, at the synagogue or whatever it is, or at school. The conventional, the standard American diet, I mean, I've got to let that thing go. It just doesn't make any rational sense to me anymore. And so you move into Whole Foods and you say, I'm not getting screwed anymore. Okay. So a scientific, materialist, or rational worldview will start to move out of processed foods into more of a Whole Foods diet. Okay. Rational has some real benefits. Paying attention to the science of nutrition, the science of food, understanding one's own physiology and what foods best feed it. Start to become a nutritional theorist a little bit at this point. Start to read some books. Think, oh yeah, maybe this Paul Bragg guy is right. Or, you know, the first guy I got into was Andrew Weil. Now, of course, he is some of the higher harmonics of the spectrum of diet too. But I mean, he holds Whole Foods really well. And so you get into people like that. You're like, I'm going to start to, you know, find out about this stuff. I'm going to apply my rational mind to it. Not just what tastes good, but what's nutritionally good for me. So scientific materialism goes a long way to help us start to heal from the ravages of some of the, you know, disadvantages of the earlier parts of the spectrum of diet. But scientific materialism doesn't go far enough. Being rational doesn't go far enough. Just because I can eat a cow or because I can access some more unprocessed or whole foods doesn't necessarily mean they're good for the environment or that they're necessarily good for me. It doesn't mean that it's kind to the cow or the chicken or the environment or whatever. So I need to move on from this. And so in your worldview development, you realize that rationality doesn't fully cut it. It doesn't necessarily treat the earth very well. It'll just harvest whatever gold it can or whatever it can mine from the environment or whatever it can create. Say, you know what? I need to take more care and concern with how I live in the world. And so rational gives rise into pluralistic. The pluralistic wave of worldview. Pluralistic, I take on multiple contexts. I listen to how this culture does and how that culture does and what this person eats and what that person eats, and I care about the cow and I care about the planet and I care about the ridiculously high cost of healthcare in the United States, for example, and I want to do something about this. I really care. That's pluralistic thinking. It's also known in spiral dynamics as the sensitive self. The sensitive self, okay? It's egalitarian. It's eco-friendly. It's generally feminist. It's multicultural. This is the worldview. The color for this in spiral dynamics is green. So when I say green, you can think green. It's eco-friendly. It's non-hierarchical, okay? It's egalitarian. And so that worldview is going to eat vegetarian, vegan, and raw vegan. And it can't stand to think about any more hierarchy. I'm tired of war. I'm tired of killing. I'm tired of the domination on this planet. I am done with it. Everybody's equal, and we treat everybody as equal completely without question, period. Right? So you see that play out a lot in the vegetarian, vegan, and raw vegan community, and it's very, very important. This is a huge developmental stage. When did this stage start? Back in the 1960s, once Rachel Carson put out Silent Spring and talked about the harm of DDT, and Earth Day came along, and there were psychedelics and free love and all kinds of stuff wrapped up in there, and Buddhism and Hinduism and the Maharishi playing around with the Beatles, and all of this stuff came around in the 60s. That was the advent of the sensitive self and pluralistic, multicultural, eco-friendly thinking or ways of being. Very important, very dramatic shift in our development. Now, if we go back, just to take this out of your own experience and look at humanity in general, because this will give you some perspective on what we've been eating throughout human history as well. This move from archaic into magic into mythic into rational and pluralistic, the archaic wave, you know, just eating whatever was available, which for us nowadays tends to be junk food, but for people, for a lot of human history, it was whatever they could get out of the environment, herbs and plants and animals. We know that from the archaeological record. Archaic took millions of years. The magic level, where you had survival bands and tribes, lasted for hundreds of thousands of years. And the mythic came in about, depending on who you ask, about 3,000 to 5,000 years ago, that wave. And particularly once you saw Hinduism and Buddhism and Islam and Christianity and those traditions rise up as cultural manifestations in part, that just happened the last few thousand years. So how long did it take for mythic to give rise into rational? Oh, well, the rational enlightenment just happened about 350 years ago. And people like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, a great philosopher, said, down with the myths, because they had seen what happened when things like, you know, the Christian church did the Inquisition. He said, oh, my gosh, I mean, this is horrible. You know, and Galileo looked through his telescope and he said, look, we're not at the center of the, you know, of the cosmos, not even at the center of this solar system. Actually, the sun is. And they killed him for it. But eventually, the rational enlightenment won the day. And we started to pay attention to rationality more than just myths. And so that just happened 350 years ago. How long did it take humanity to move from mythic thinking into, rational thinking into pluralistic thinking? From the rational enlightenment into pluralism in the 1960s? Just a couple hundred years. How long has it taken for us to move from pluralistic thinking into what I'm going to present next, which is integral thinking? This just happened in the last 15 years, really. If you feel like the world is speeding up on you, it's because it is. The leading edge in particular is speeding up. It's getting so fast, even people from like Wired magazine are saying, you know what, the technology is progressing so fast, we'd like it to slow down. We can't keep up. We just can't keep up anymore. People like Ray Kurzweil, who wrote The Singularity is Near, is talking about this, how the knowing and the capacities of human beings is continuing to increase at an exponential rate, which is why you've seen this move of worldviews from archaic to magic to mythic to rational to pluralistic and finally into integral, which I'll qualify in a moment, why that has sped up so much over the last few million years right down to the present day. So what is integral thinking? I've talked about it a bit today, but we'll just touch on it again. An integral thinker looks back down, let's say, through the spectrum of diet and sees value to the entire thing, or looks back all the way back to archaic and the earliest parts of human existence and says, you know what, there are elements of that that were healthy that have been brought forward all the way to the present day. They're all important. Or as a child, I was in an archaic level of existence. I ate Jolly Ranchers. Okay, that makes sense for me, given, you know, that I live in this culture, that I would do that. Or that I was in a magic level of existence and I ate Fruit Loops and went to McDonald's. That makes sense to me. And when in college, you know, when I eventually got into rational thinking, I started to read Andrew Weil, and I started to think, you know, I've got to take on more perspectives here. And I started to develop more care and concern ultimately and moved into pluralistic thinking and ate a vegetarian, vegan, and raw vegan diet. That makes sense to me. You know? So integral thinking sees the value of it all. And this goes for any line of development. If you do calculus, you don't look back on the addition and multiplication tables that you did in first grade and think, oh, what a joke. Like, oh, it was really valuable. You know, I still use that stuff today, but I also do calculus or some kind of advanced math. So the problem with what we call first-tier thinking, now this is a new term, first-tier, All of these levels, from archaic to magic to mythic to rational to pluralistic, are in spiral dynamics terms what we call first tier. What do we mean by first tier? First tier means that anybody at any one of those levels of worldview looks at everybody else and thinks they're an idiot. So I'll give you an example. Think of somebody that you know that has a lot of the characteristics of a George Bush type character. Had 8 long years of George Bush. That was interesting. George Bush looks at somebody who is at a what we'll call a higher level of development, green, multicultural, eco-friendly, feminist, egalitarian. And he's like, oh, you guys are so weak and woo-woo. And Green looks back at George Bush, who's more at a fundamental, conventional level of existence, mythic, believes the Bible is literally true. And they're like, oh, you are so deluded. And so ethnocentric. God, how could you go to war against Iraq, you know, or bomb other countries? So insensitive. Why would Green say that? Because Green's the sensitive self. Okay. Green looks at the low level below it, which is rational, and it says, all this industrialization, oh my gosh, I mean, just raping and pillaging the earth, you know, moving indigenous people off of their land. And this is all true. But they look at it and they say, God, people who are just purely rational are such idiots. I'm so upset by them. I don't want to have anything to do with it anymore. And so they try to get rid of their laptop or the diet that they ate at that particular level, or deny that their particular worldview is in any way based on the fact that we had a rational wave of worldview that came in 300 years ago. They just would like to pretend that, I just would have always thought this way. Not true. Not true. All of these waves have been really important to get you up to the particular level of worldview that you're at right now, which for many of us listening right now is a green, pluralistic, multicultural, eco-friendly worldview. Very high level of development, very important. But the mistake, one of the mistakes that we've made, is to look back down at those lower levels and think that everybody is deluded. Instead of saying, you know what, it's levels of truth all the way through. Now, when you make the jump from all these first tier waves or worldviews into what in spiral dynamics terms we call second tier, you look back down and you say it's all valuable. It's all valuable. And I know when to access these different levels of being or knowing. Okay. So for me, sometimes if you want to go out and get a job, then you don't access the green meme, you know, just being pluralistic and eco-friendly and all of that. You actually actualize more of a conventional mythic kind of way of being, meaning that these are the rules. This is what I have to do. I've got to go out and find a job. These are the people I have to talk to. Here's my resume. Boom, it's all lined up. Okay. So you can actualize that aspect of your being. Or you need to study nutrition, you know, like you and I do, Kevin. A lot of what you access is your own rational mind. How can I look at the science of this and get that perspective? Okay. But it doesn't necessarily go far enough. We've also got to look at the impact on other beings. Where does integral nutrition play in? So integral nutrition, for me, my perspective on this is that because we are acknowledging all the levels all the way through and eating as high up on the chain of command, nutritionally speaking, as we can, one does integrate or reintegrate animal products into their diet, but with all of the perspectives they've ever had. I know when this interview goes out, there's going to be a whole lot of raw vegans who are going to argue against this. But I have looked at the nutritional data and have felt into my own experience and the experience of other people who have been raw vegan for a long time, and people do go what I consider to be post-raw vegan. Now, again, if I talked to my vegan self or my raw vegan self 3 years ago, I would have told you this was backtracking. I would not have been able to see this. But it is post-raw vegan. It is a developmental level higher, nutritionally speaking, than I consider raw vegan to be. Now, people will ask, how could that be if you're killing animals? That's a really excellent question. How could that be? The reason is this. A human being is probably the most unique and highly developed thing that we know of. A human being is more miraculous than anything else on the planet. And that doesn't mean that we're here to dominate the rest of the planet, but that the rest of the cosmos or the rest of the planet is contained within us. I mean, think about if you created a Ferrari or a Lamborghini. I mean, just like a, you know, or the Tesla car. I mean, like the height of automobile technology. What would it require? It would require everything you could possibly bring to bear to create that kind of high level of organization. To me, and looking back over human history and how we developed the neocortex, it tells me that given the depth of a human being, the reason that we were able to develop a neocortex and the amazing capacities that we have, including the capacity to be compassionate to animals, the reason we were able to develop these capacities is because we were able to access every last nutrient available to us on the planet and incorporate it into our being and develop over hundreds of thousands of years into who we are now. I am at a point now where I recognize that I am not about to start leaving out certain aspects of the cosmos, nutritionally speaking. And that doesn't mean that I'm not compassionate or I don't care. But animal products are in some ways part of our history, not in some ways, they are part of our history. Our physiology is designed to take them on. We are omnivores. I definitely agree with Michael Pollan and many other people along these lines. We are designed to take these on, and one of the reasons is because when an animal eats plants, it creates certain nutrients in itself that were not in existence in the plant at all, or at least not in the ways that they are in the animal. This is holonic development, or a developmental hierarchy. The soil moves into a plant, and the plant has things in it that the soil didn't have, and the plant is eaten by an animal. And the animal creates things like hormones and other special nutrients in it. It upgrades iron. It upgrades B12 or creates B12 in itself. It upgrades fats. It's all kinds of things that an animal concentrates in itself, trace elements. And it concentrates those in itself. And the animal, you just take a cow, for example, which is an absolute miracle in the cosmos. It has things in itself that were not present at a lower level of development. So as the cosmos moves from dirt into grass into cow, you get increasing levels of capacities and increasing levels of organization. And human beings have taken on, mostly wild animals, but have taken on some of these specially concentrated nutrients and emergent qualities of animals and eaten those things and created ourselves into what we are now. Okay, which we have a neocortex and we have unbelievable capabilities and capacities. And the question for me as a sensitive self, as somebody who wants to see the continuation of all beings, is how to access animal products in a way that doesn't put an end to all beings, that contributes to biodiversity, and it contributes to the continuation of humanity on the planet. And an industrialized diet doesn't cut it. We were completely right at the raw vegan level about that. Industrialization doesn't cut it. It's going to have to be something that's post-industrial. We've also got to remember past agricultural techniques and bring them forward, and then also some of the things that we've learned in the past 100 years. Nutritionally speaking, agriculturally speaking, in terms of international commerce, et cetera, there's all kinds of new emergence that have happened that can inform us on how our agriculture should be in a post-industrial approach. It's going to be more local. It's going to be more nutrient dense maybe than we've ever had, but it will involve animals. I don't see how we can divorce animals from the health of the biosphere. I don't see how we can divorce animals from a healthy agriculture. Now, that is a debate that can play out there, but you talk to just about anybody who does really good organic agriculture, and they'll tell you that animal inputs have been absolutely essential in the farming that they do. Even people who don't want to harm animals. You know, it's about living synergistically with other animals. I like to draw this point out also just a little bit more, having been a raw vegan for so many years and having been a vegetarian for like 17 years prior to starting to incorporate animal products in my diet. The great American poet and mystic Gary Snyder talked a lot about Native American cultures, and he said it's very important to differentiate between killing and putting an end to life. Now, a Native American who goes out into the plains and kills a buffalo is killing that buffalo. And let's not be mistaken. The buffalo does suffer as it dies. But the whole herd of buffalo, the existence of buffalo in general, continues on. And the Native American says, well, you know, I do have to kill this one buffalo, and I'm going to honor this buffalo, but I also honor all buffalo and I honor the existence of my family and humanity on the planet too. And so I'm going to kill in such a way that I'm not putting an end to life. And what we mean by that is not ending all buffalo. We're doing it in such a way that it damages the ability of other beings to exist. And most of our industrialized modern agribusiness has not been in service to the continuance of species on this planet, including human beings. We're putting ourselves at risk. So how can we farm an integrated diet that includes some animal products in service to ourselves, in service to the soil and a healthy agriculture, in a way that doesn't put an end to life? It's a huge question, but it's one we've got to focus on. I've jumped ahead just a little bit because we haven't talked about the vegan narrative yet, but I'm starting to get into it here just a little bit.
So let's talk about the vegan narrative, and okay, and then we'll kind of wrap up some of the discussion, and then we'll open it up to questions for those who have been listening. So then you can write, you can respond not just my questions but everyone else's.
Okay. So one of the hallmarks of what I call the vegan narrative, and what we mean by that is, what's the worldview of somebody who's eating a vegan or a raw vegan diet, and how does that impact their way of looking at nutritional data or the diets of other people or what's appropriate for themselves to eat or the archaeological record, et cetera? I mean, so the vegan narrative plays into your worldview. And I can see moving into a post, what I call a post-raw vegan or an integrated perspective on nutrition, that I wasn't seeing things as clearly as I do now. But you're never as critical of a stage as you are when you move beyond that stage. You know, so I can be much more critical of my worldview in junior high than I could when I was in junior high, for example. So one of the hallmarks of the vegan narrative, and when I say narrative, I'm not necessarily putting these things down. They're all legitimate, but it plays into a story that we tell that is a level of truth, but there may be something missing. So that's what I'm meaning. I'm not being demeaning. I mean, I think all of these things are really important. The sensitive self is really there. And I think one of the big aspects of the vegan narrative is that we have really recoiled in response to all of the killing and the destruction that we see in front of our eyes every day. We see unhealthy people walking down the street. We can read thousands of books on ecological destruction. We see war. We see the domination of animals. We say, I've had enough of it. I've absolutely had enough, and I will live my life to make sure that this is put to an end. And I will not have anything to do with killing anymore. And that is a very important way of being to start to cultivate. Where it's partial and where we start to go wrong is in not fully recognizing that in order for matter to move into body, into mind, into soul, into spirit, and for a human being to be the miracle that they are, that killing is necessary for us to live. Dying is necessary. We just went to the Museum of Natural Science in Houston, and they've got a great display of sea creatures, for example. And they used an electron microscope to find the smallest shells that have ever been identified. These things are like, you know, a few microns across. They're tiny. Small organisms have to die to give way into higher levels of being in the cosmos. The perennial philosophy or the great chain of being involves death at lower levels so that higher levels can come into being. It's just the way that it is. And so to think that, well, I eat 100% plant-based raw vegan diet, and so there's no death involved in my life whatsoever, I'm sorry, but it's not true. Your intentions are really, really good, and in some ways you have reduced your impact on the planet immensely, like we all have by eating a raw vegan diet, but there's still dying involved. For a lot of raw vegans, their produce is trucked thousands of miles. Even the organic agriculture, I mean, if you read Michael Pollan's book, or I don't entirely agree with all of the book, but The Vegetarian Myth by Lierre Keith, you know, she illustrates really well how much dying is involved in creating vegetables. The vegetable itself has got to die. So what a raw vegan tends to do, and part of our vegan narrative, is to say, well, there's a certain level of depth at which I draw the line. And so what happens is we forget about all of the lower levels of existence, all the bacteria and the small rodents that live on farms that end up dying, and et cetera, et cetera. There's a whole lot of death actually around a field of produce. And not to mention the petroleum industry that creates it and delivers it. There is so much death around the petroleum industry, and I don't think there's going to be any raw vegan who's going to go to bat for big oil, probably creating more death and destruction than anything else on the planet. And a raw vegan diet is heavily dependent on the petroleum industry. So you can't eat a raw vegan diet without killing, and so you've got to recognize that death is a part of existence. An integral way of thinking, to me, is recognizing that that is true. And so I'm not going to somehow get away with killing not being present in order for me to live. So then it's a matter of what's the nature of the killing, how much actually needs to happen, and is the killing happening in such a way that I'm actually putting an end to all life? Now, I will argue that a pound of beef that's raised on Vancouver Island, a few miles away from me, from a cow that eats grass, is better for the environment than the bananas that are brought up from Ecuador or Mexico all the way up to here. There's more killing, there's more death involved in those bananas than there are in that pound of grass-fed beef from just that happy cow raised by a small-scale farmer. We've got to start thinking that way. There's a whole lot of supplementation that goes into particularly like a raw vegan diet. Where do those supplements come from? All over the place. They have to be trucked from all over. You know? So my experience with the raw vegan community, including having lived at the Tree of Life Rejuvenation Center in Arizona, there's a lot of good intentions around growing food, but I would say that the majority of the raw vegan community or the plant-based community is heavily reliant on petroleum products, and that is probably diminishing our possibility for continuance greater than anything else. So we've got to move into a post-industrial place with this. But that plays into the raw vegan narrative or the vegan narrative really strongly. There's no killing involved in my existence. Not true. And in fact, you can eat a raw vegan diet in a way that probably contributes to more killing than somebody who lives right on their land and raises chickens and a cow and grows most of their own food, I would argue. Okay. So we've got to start realizing that. The other thing that I see, and again, I was right there in it. So I'm not just criticizing, you know, or not qualifying people who are out there. I'm qualifying myself, too, a few years ago. There's a great immortality project going on, I think, in the nutritional community in general, but particularly in the plant-based community, that I'm going to remove all of the causes of disease and I'm going to live forever, or I'm going to live for 120 years or 140 years, or as David Wolf has stated, his goal is to live to be 3,000 years old, which is interesting. I mean, I'd like to see what would happen if somebody was able to continue to do developmental practice for 3,000 years and what that human being would be. But is this really what we want to be going for? You know, what is behind this immortality project? And I would suggest, having read people like Ernest Becker, who wrote a book called The Denial of Death, that what's really going on here for a lot of us, because we have looked illness in the face, that's why many of us go vegetarian, vegan, or raw vegan, is to heal some health challenge, that we've looked illness or discomfort in the face, and we've gotten a little taste of death, and we don't like it. I looked death in the face for 3 years before I found out about juice feasting, and thank God for John Rose and teaching me about juice feasting and raw food so that I could heal it. But I mean, thinking most days that I was about to have a heart attack or die or my system was going to freak out, that was not pleasant. I wanted anything but that. And so we created an immortality project, and I definitely created an immortality project for myself. I will eat in such a way that I'm not contributing to disease whatsoever, ever, 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 right? And there's a lot of fear behind that. And so we start to say, oh, I want to live to be 120 or 140 or 3,000 years old or whatever. Also wrapped up in that immortality project is a heroism project. How many people out there are making themselves up to be superheroes in the raw vegan movement, for example? I have pushed that myself. I talk about the hero's journey, which is a true journey. You know, Joseph Campbell talks about it. In The Hero with a Thousand Faces, Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist, the hero's journey really does play out. But we've taken it pretty far in the raw vegan movement, for example, and consider ourselves to be heroes. And the hero wants to be a hero, in part because what's behind that is the fact that you aren't going to live forever. You're going to die. And I think that this denial of death plays into the desire to not eat animals, for example. We just don't want to acknowledge the existence of death. We think that we can put it off forever, and we can put it off everywhere. I mean, the height of it is like Lee R. Keith talks about some vegan on a message board one time who said they wanted to put a fence down the center of Africa and put the predators and prey on opposite sides of the fence to protect all the animals. This is just not the way the cosmos works. You know, lower levels give rise to higher levels all the way through. And again, I include eating animals in that, in an appropriate level, and we may not even have time to get into that today, but it's going to be part of the ongoing debate. But some animal products coming in, I think, are important for longevity and do honor our physiology as omnivores. Okay. So that heroism project and that immortality project do play into this denial of death that I see in the vegan and raw vegan movement. I also see as part of the narrative that we know best. We know absolutely best for everybody. If everyone would simply eat a vegetarian, a vegan, or a raw vegan diet, then everyone could be fed, we would save our economic system, our political system, the medical system, et cetera. And there's some partial truths to that. I think we put ourselves up too much on a pedestal. And I think it does us a disservice in terms of encouraging people along into what's realistic for the world. We think that we've got some kind of a monolithic nutritional imperative that we can apply to everybody. Everybody should eat vegan or everybody should eat raw vegan. And I'm not finding that it works that way. There are too many factors that are playing into what a person eats that they're based on. It's a synergy. It's based on biochemical individuality. And these are things that were brought up in the Great Health Debate. Biochemical individuality, the seasons, your bioregion, your current economic situation for you or for your society, the availability of food, I mean, what actually is available, your activity level, your type of activity, your worldview, your spiritual practice, the health challenges that you have, your type of work, whether you're more masculine or feminine, whether you're looking for more freedom, which would be more on the side of like raw vegan or light eating, or whether you want more fullness, which would be more on the side of more calories and cultivating more of a sense of fullness, which could be very valid given a particular emotional state or life circumstance. All of those things play in to what you eat. And to think that we can establish some kind of monolithic nutritional imperative that's going to apply to everybody is ignoring all of these realities, I think. So what we can do is honor and incorporate all of those realities and realize that we need to be in a flex flow. There's an ever-evolving synergy of what's possible, nutritionally speaking. We can start to look at some deep features, though. You know, I think the deep features are moving up the spectrum of diet and seeing those stages. I also think the deep features are moving into a post-industrial way of eating, for example. That if we're eating industrialized processed food, then we're definitely not doing well. You know. Other deep features of our lives, I mean, things we talked about earlier, getting plenty of exercise, getting out in the sun, having some kind of a spiritual practice, having a community of people who love you, being in a positive relationship, all these things are nutrients. Dr. Cousins did a really good job at expanding the definition of nutrition in spiritual nutrition and saying there are multiple levels of nutrients and we need to pay attention to all of them. So it goes well beyond just the food that you eat. But we've got to move into a post-industrial place. I think that's one of the most important deep features that I can suggest if we're trying to put out something that applies to just about everybody in the westernized world. We're ready for that. And I'm saying that including the raw vegan movement. There are a lot of people who eat a very industrialized raw vegan diet, you know, eating tons of fruit when you don't live anywhere near where that fruit's grown. That takes a real toll on the environment, and therefore it's going to ultimately limit biodiversity. So we've got to look at getting more local and getting more non-processed.
So there's kind of two things that we promised. One was, you know, you mentioned some of the ways to apply it all practically. So we need to determine, you know, how this, you know, how you can fit this into what you're supposed to eat. And then the second part is you know, the reason why you brought animal products in, you know, more so than just being cold, because I think that needs to be explained a little bit more.
Right. Okay. So let's address the second question first. So why did I start incorporating animal products? The main reason for me initially was being cold. And I got incredibly cold living up here eating a raw vegan diet. And people will ask, so what did you do to try to fix that? Were you getting exercise? The answer is yes. I'm from Texas. My physiology was developed in Texas. When I exercise, I sweat like crazy. And being in a cold environment and getting out and exercising makes you sweat more, which makes you further cold. My friends up here who grew up in British Columbia, we were out doing Qigong one day, and we were doing a bunch of exercises that would build up body heat. And after the Qigong was over, we did it for about an hour, I asked everybody in the group, how do you feel? Do you feel hot or cold at this point? And I went around, and everybody from Canada, which was everybody there except for me, said that they felt warm. And they said, how do you feel? And I said, I feel freezing cold. I said, did you feel cold while you were exercising? I said, no, not so much. I mean, I felt some heat kind of building up. But now that we've finished, I am so, so cold. Why? Well, because if you live in Texas, your body's got to dissipate heat. It's got to be very good at that. And so my body is excellent at dissipating excess heat so that I don't overheat in the environment from which I'm from. So when I came up here, I got really cold. And I continued to eat a raw vegan diet. And I was incorporating plenty of ginger and hot teas. I started to drink hot water instead of cold water. I was getting exercise. I was sitting in front of the fire. I was wearing plenty of clothes. I couldn't figure it out. I kept changing up my diet. I started to incorporate more cooked foods. Started to eat cooked rice and cooked beans and cooked quinoa and steamed vegetables. And I added nettles into my diet. It didn't work. I was still freezing cold. I mean, I looked outside at the weather, which is like this way for like 7 or 8 months out of the year, and I said, I just cannot stand to get outside. I won't go. I just won't go. I started to tighten up in my body because I was just so perpetually cold. It affected my sex drive. It affected my ability to create. It started to have an impact on what I thought I knew about nutrition. It affected my passion for being able to coach people on the things most important to them. And so I felt just an overall decrease in my ability to be my authentic, unique self. And it was very uncomfortable. And we have some friends up here who eat a largely plant-based diet with some meat. And I started to talk with them about it. And they said, why don't you try? And I said, okay. And so I started to eat eggs. I started to feel a little bit better. Like I felt more fullness in my system. I started to feel some of my energy come back in terms of my creativity, in terms of my warmth. Whether or not you feel sexually inclined, I think is a good indication of where your energy is at. That started to come back a bit. And Katrina and I decided to, she had done some reading online. She was reading Daniel Vitalis, for example, who I know there's a big debate out there about Daniel right now. I guess I'm entering the fray now. But she'd been reading Daniel and maybe listened to an interview of Daniel's, and she on her own went outside the house and she got several different types of meat that were grown right there on the island that we lived on. I mean, she knew the farmers. And brought it home and got a bunch of wild greens that were right there from the island, I mean, just within a mile radius of us. Steamed up the greens, cooked the beef, put it on the plate. We sat down, and the butter and the beef and the greens were all from like within a mile or probably 2 miles radius of us. We sat down and I looked outside of our house and it was pouring down rain and it was so cold and foggy. And I looked at the weather and I looked at my plate and I started to eat the food. And I mean, now this is somebody who's been eating vegetarian for like 17 years. And as I ate it, I realized that what I was eating matched the weather outside. And I started to realize why people in northern climates like Eskimos eat more nutrient-dense foods such as what animals create in themselves. And I will say, because of the way that hierarchical development occurs, animals concentrate nutrients more than plants do on balance. Because they're eating plants, the next level of development's got to have more depth to it. And that's been my experience starting to integrate animal products, is that my energy has come back online. And I don't mind the cold anymore. I'll walk right out into the freezing rain now, and I'm fine. My sex drive is good. My creative energy is excellent. I realized, finally it popped into my head. I'm like, we need an integrated diet that incorporates the best aspects all the way up the spectrum of diet and incorporates all of these different variabilities that we have to consider, such as where you live And the fact that you're a human being with a neocortex that's developed up through millions of years of evolutionary development and did rely on animal products, and it's written into your physiology that you can access those nutrients, and that it was absolutely necessary for us to survive and to be the way that we are now. So I feel like I'm honoring the past, I'm honoring the present, I'm honoring my own physiology, I'm honoring everything that I've ever learned about nutrition in the way that I eat now. I've not dissociated, I haven't backtracked, I'm not eating less compassionately now. I realize that killing is necessary for me to exist, and in some cases that does mean that the killing goes all the way up to the depth of a chicken or a cow or a buffalo. Is that a cause for sadness for me? In that death has to happen for life to happen, it is a sadness. What's a greater sadness for me is that we've done it in such a way for the last 100 or 150 years that we may have compromised our ability to live on this planet. And that's a huge concern. And it breaks my heart to see so much preventable disease out there and ecological destruction. But I am seeing, and you can read it in books like Omnivore's Dilemma and read a guy named Joel Salatin, for example, he's just one example. We can grow food in such a way that it honors the environment, including animals, that we can raise animals for food in a way that still honors the animals themselves and the environment and ourselves and future generations. And that is a debate that will continue to rage on. So the other question you asked was, how do we integrate all this information? It's a long, long question. All those things that I just suggested, biochemical individuality, seasons, bioregion, economics, food availability, your activity level, your worldview, your spiritual practice, your various health challenges or your health challenge, your type of work that you do, whether you're more masculine or feminine, whether you're going for more freedom in your life at this point, maybe for spiritual reasons, or you're going for more fullness because you've got a job to do that requires more dense foods. All of those things play in, and so it behooves us to learn about all of those things and to not be afraid of continuing to grow and develop, nutritionally speaking. You've got to listen to everybody and look at where they're at in the spectrum of diet and look at where you're at and make some really excellent choices. And it takes time, and it's not going to be perfect. That's one of the myths of many dietary advocates, is that they have the perfect approach to nutrition. There is no perfect approach to nutrition except for the one that you're currently integrating based on the best of your abilities. Life is an art project. It's incredibly complex and enjoyable and worth it. So you're not going to find a perfect diet ever, except for the one that you're eating today, and it will be superseded by the way that you eat next month or next year. You'll keep on learning. You'll keep on integrating. But if you hold yourself to fundamentally one type of diet to exclude some particular other types of food or nutrients, you may find yourself uncomfortable and finally outliving that particular stage in your development. So watch out for the fundamentalism long term. Fundamentally being a vegetarian, a vegan, a raw vegan, or whatever it is that you're doing, nutritionally speaking, it will outlive its usefulness. I guarantee it. If you don't allow it to outlive its usefulness, you're just going to look pathological. And there are some really good examples of that out there. Now, one thing I'd also like to say here at the end, because I've been vegetarian and raw vegan for so long, and because I was at the epicenter of that movement, I really did want to read off this list of people that we really hold in high regard who've advocated, and I'm saying appropriately advocated, moving into a largely plant-based diet where your center of gravity is on plant-based. Okay, people like Daniel Vitalis, Frank Giglio, who worked at the Tree of Life Rejuvenation Center as a chef, Malcolm and Laura Saunders, who worked at the Tree of Life Rejuvenation Center with me and I consider to be good friends. Paul Nisan is a longtime raw vegan advocate who has brought in some animal products. Anthony Anderson, who calls himself Raw Model, has brought in animal products. David Wolf, who has even tried bovine colostrum at this point, but has said, I don't really want to kill the animals, but I do want to access animal products. you notice David wrote Nature's First Law, and he's come a long way since then. It's like, no supplements, okay, now supplements, now superfoods, okay, now maybe some animal products. That's a pretty common progression. Frederick Patino, who says that he eats ceviche when he is away from home sometimes, and I'm not sure what else Frederick eats, but he's put some animal products in there. Also, John Tilden, Herbert Shelton, Norman Walker, Paul Bragg, Jack LaLanne, Harvey Diamond, who wrote Fit for Life and had the famous phrase that, you know, if you put a child, if you put a baby in a crib with an apple and a rabbit, and if the child eats the rabbit, then I'll give you a new car. That Harvey Diamond included animal products in his diet. And Max Gerson and the Gerson Institute still use animal products in their protocol. So that's a long line of people who have very appropriately advocated that we place our center of gravity on plant-based and yet have incorporated a small amount of animal products into their diet. And I think that it's that small amount of animal products, if they're appropriately chosen, that can make the difference for us being supported in our diet long-term, as opposed to some of the short-term, very true benefits that we get from eating 100% plant-based diet, which I think is incredible, benefits us in many, many ways. But long-term, I can say I'm moving on, and I'm with a whole lot of other people who've advocated a plant-based diet and have also moved on to incorporate a small portion of animal products into their diet and felt much more balanced by it in many respects. So we may need to end up there for today. What other questions did you have before we go?
Well, I think that's going to be it for today because we've run out of time. We've gone 2 hours here, so I think that's sufficient. And what I'm going to ask everyone who's listening now is to post your questions on the blog. So I have a bunch of questions, but I feel it's probably better to let you guys get your questions in, and then we'll have David come back either by interview or written to answer some of the most pressing questions. I think that's about. Do you think that's a good idea, David?
That's fantastic, and I really am encouraging the discussion now. And I'm not like I'm blazing a path here. I mean, there's a lot of other people who are talking this way as well. I think an integral perspective and the work I've done on Ken Wilber's stuff has really helped to clarify a lot of what we're talking about, all of us. So thank you very much for having me on, Kevin. I mean, the opportunity is amazing.
And thank you so much for sharing. I'm thrilled to have this as part of the blog to let, you know, the listeners decide on their own, you know, what they think is valuable and what they think is not. And I'm sure you would agree.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I consider everybody so brave who's doing this. Thank you so much for being so conscientious about taking care of your diet, and not just in service to you, but in service to all beings.
And this is David Reinoshek and Kevin Gianni, or this is Kevin Gianni with David Reinoshek. I want to thank you guys for listening, and we will talk to you soon. Take care. Bye.